everybody. It is Sunday, October 6th, and this is your episode number 200.
That's the JMU fight song. That's all I could find.
Casey was real proud of that one. This is episode 200 of the At Percussion podcast. With me, as always, are Carly Vigna.
Hi, everyone.
And Casey Cangelosi.
Oh, that's fine. Sorry.
Yeah. Casey, I think you have some episode 200 stats for us.
We reported on a lot. I mean, as I was writing all these down, I thought, I'll give a summary of everything we've covered in the last 100 episodes. So just stop me when you don't want to hear any more. But Ben, you covered Zakir Hussain, Claire Omar Musser, Rosewood Extinction, Anders Koppel, Sheila E., Eric Samu, Jacob TV, Baby Dodds, Taiko Drumming, Female and Minority Composers, Alejandro Vignal, Six Mallets, and Pi Ching Wu of the Jew Percussion Group, Ghost Setting with a Sense of Realism and Psychology of Unrealistic Goals, Middle and High School Level Difficulty Rankings of Percussion Repertoire, Bang on a Can, Julia Wolf, and David Gordon, Bill Mersch, John Sathis, Keiko Abe's Marimba Village. You want me to stop? I'm halfway through. I was going to see how fast I could read them. And then there's my list, but we don't even have to do that. And Carly's list.
Yeah. Casey, what's your favorite topic that you've had so far?
Oh, geez. Well, good thing I have this handy dandy list right here. It's funny because sometimes your favorite topic was not the one like I presented the best. But I think if I had to blend the two and say one that I thought was really interesting and I felt like I presented well. Do you remember when I played Bolero in the style of, that's not even the right thing to say, but I did Alvin Lucier's I'm Sitting in a Room, but with Bolero?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. I don't know. I wish I had more time to do that sort of thing. Like actually, you know, not just find a sound to present, but actually recreate someone's. And that was really fun. So yeah, Alvin Lucier's I'm Sitting in a Room. He says this line of text, records it, plays it back, records the playback, and repeats that process over and over until it's just this standing drone. So I did that with Bolero, and it turned into a standing drone pretty quickly. So yeah, that might have been my favorite.
I think for me, my favorites are always just getting to talk about people that I've met or that like I maybe will meet. And it's been fun having a couple that I've covered that we then later on had on the podcast, like Bill Mersch and John Haas were a couple of those examples. And Carly, I think you had something to say.
Yeah, you know, I just want to say on a serious note, thank you to Casey and Ben for starting this thing and keeping it going. Like, there's such a wealth of information, even just in the past 30 episodes or so that I've been involved. And of course, also thank you to Megan Arnes and Laurel Black for all of their contributions over the years.
For sure.
I salute you. This is something like, I don't know, episode 28 for me. So you've been in it for the long haul. Mm. Yeah, I know that I've learned a ton as a listener first and now as a co-host from hearing everything and from chatting with so many, you know, totally different kinds of guests. That makes me a better teacher and a better performer, better musician. So thank you for this contribution.
You're welcome.
Of course. I had one more stat to share, and that is that so far on this podcast of 200 episodes, we have had 8 Percussive Arts Society Hall of Fame members. Technically only 7 at this point because Mike Rosen is being inducted this year at PASIC, but we'll go ahead
and count.
But I wish I was smart enough to have actually made the list of who those people were, but off the top of my head, Lee Howard Stevens, Mike Rosen, and Gordon Stout, who I know were 3 of them, Steve Schick, and I wish I had the other 4 listed.
Emil Richards
for sure was one of them. Yeah, that's 5 or 3 others. Oh, Bill Kahn of Nexus was one of them.
Right.
And 2 others. We'll get those by the end of the episode.
Right.
But anyway, so all 200 episode celebration aside, we have a guest with us today, as always. Today's guest is Dr. Franco Perez. He is a percussionist, composer, and educator from Pflugerville, Texas. He currently serves as assistant professor of music and percussion at Lamar University in Beaumont, Texas, where he oversees all aspects of the percussion studio. As an active performer, he's accepted international engagements in Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, Spain, and China, and toured extensively throughout the U.S., including performances at prestigious venues such as Carnegie Hall, Merkin Hall, and the Percussive Arts Society International Convention. He's performed with various professional ensembles such as the Lexington Philharmonic, the Symphony of Southeast Texas, and is a founding member of the Blue Shift Percussion Quartet. Dedicated to the expansion of chamber percussion music, Blue Shift has performed throughout Colorado, Illinois, Iowa, Kentucky, and Tennessee. So welcome, Dr. Franco Perez.
Hey, hey all. Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you all again for all your contributions and with this invaluable resource for all of us. It's really, really been awesome listening over the years.
Yeah. It's hard to ignore after I listed all those names Ben covered. It's hard to deny.
It's also funny for us. We definitely get to the point where, oh, I think today on the podcast I'll talk about Steve Schick. Wait, have we already done that? And then, oh, yeah, we did, like 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's true.
So before we record one of these episodes, a lot of the time we sort of introduce ourselves and say hi. You know, I don't know if you remember, we met at PSIC in 2014 or something, and I actually just met Franco. Was that last semester?
Yeah, it was like in April, I believe.
Yeah, we were both at Lake Dallas High School with my friend Frankie Burke, doing Frankie's sort of solo and ensemble festival as clinicians, and Franco had just completed a new piece for percussion orchestra for them. So, Franco, could you tell us about that piece?
Yeah, it was actually finally after like a year and a half of being in the works. Frankie had commissioned me to write a piece for a percussion orchestra. They played one of my other pieces a few years beforehand, and he just wanted to get another one out, another commissioned. And the first time he tried to make it into like a consortium type thing, which didn't end up working out, but luckily he was able to do it just all as a standalone thing, and I was very appreciative to write that thing and then go work on it with his students during that festival. But yeah, it's the longest piece I've written and the one with the most players. It's a beast.
What is the longest you've written? What is that?
This piece, it was 12 and a half minutes, so not crazy long, but for me it was.
How many long, players though?
It is 15, I believe, 15 or 16. I think it's 15 plus piano.
How long is Pulsar?
Pulsar, I think it's like seven and a half minutes.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say, I thought it was pretty substantial, you know, snare drum and tape. I have a student doing that now. And yeah, I don't know. I wonder, because yeah, I think 12 minutes is, I mean, that's a substantial amount of work. And I guess speaking of Pulsar, can you talk about writing with tape? Because I get this question a lot, so I think it'd be great to throw to you. Writing to tape versus writing just pure acoustic, and is the approach different? Mm-hmm. And how so, if it is different?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it really has interested me for quite a while. I listen to a lot of electronic music, which kind of lends itself into kind of the compositional style I might have, but also I find it so hard to write a solo by itself. I really do, which is why I really haven't written a standalone solo. Pretty much everything I've written has always been with playback. But, you know, that was one thing I really got interested in, just kind of starting out with Fruity Loops, you know, making some beats and some tracks for some friends in high school. And then as I got into college, I got really, really into it. And it just naturally made its way into alongside of me starting to write for percussion. You know, I think it is a difficult thing to kind of go through. Just simply because of the sounds that we might have, you know, think of why things sound like they're from the 70s, why things sound like they're from the 80s. And I mean, even in our time, you know, 10, 20 years, 30 years maybe of percussion and electronic stuff, you know, you can hear some pieces that are pretty outdated. But at the same time, you know, I find it interesting and an interesting challenge to make it a way to enhance whatever solo you're playing. So I always try to make it an interactive thing instead of just a playback and then here's a solo on top of it. So the narrative between the two really interests me.
I think it's interesting how sometimes...
Time out. Franco, could you turn on a light? You're just getting darker and darker.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
I thought we could do a Batman overlay or something.
How's that?
That's great. You started fine, then all of a sudden I was like, it's just black. Sorry, go ahead, Casey.
It did get really dark. I was going to say, you said some playbacks sound dated. Are you talking about your own? Or are you talking about other people's playbacks, maybe from older times?
Yeah. So, not necessarily dated in a bad way, but it just like you hear some that has, it just sounds like it was written as it has been years ago. I think it's nice to think about, like composers such as Steve Reich, who make all the counterpoint pieces, so they record themselves on actual acoustic instruments, which kind of adds a different perspective to playback.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how sometimes older playback pieces nowadays, they sound newer. Like I listen to Temescal, or I've been getting into the Daphne Oram lately, and just some of the old BBC Radiophonic Workshop pieces. And yeah, although the sounds are clearly on older machines, it sounds like newer music. But sorry, Carly, I think you were going to say something.
Yeah, I'm glad we're jumping right in, Franco, and talking about your compositions. I actually have your marimba quartet Nalu on deck. I think I'm going to be programming it at FIU next semester. So I wanted to ask you, has composition always been a part of your life as a percussionist? And if not, what first inspired you to start composing and publishing your works?
Once I got into college, once I started undergrad, I just really liked improvising. And I think that kind of lent itself because of my upbringing. I started on piano before I started percussion. And my dad is a guitar player and he is not classically trained whatsoever. So he and I would play and, it was a lot of trying to figure things out by rote, figuring out chords. And he always wanted me to like just mess around with melodies. And I think that's where it really kind of started. But it really wasn't until I think like my junior year of undergrad that I actually wrote my first piece. Just like some etudes on marimba. I have no idea where they are, but it's just one of those things that I've just always been interested in. Anytime I wrote a piece for one of my friends for school and I heard it play, I was just so excited to hear it, and I've just always been trying to capture that, and it's always been an interest of mine.
I'm guessing it was fueled by your experience at TCU with Brian West, because I remember, it was at that time he was doing this whole percussion orchestra thing that he's so known for, and of course he's commissioning all these new pieces, and you all are making all those recordings, because you were there at that time, right?
Yeah, I was there from 08 to 13. Yeah, so we recorded a substantial amount of commissions, and I think I was also just being in that moment. It was like, okay, well, we are part of creating music, so not just by commissioning works, but also just writing. Always an interest of mine.
So I had a question, because I actually got to watch Franco briefly. I got to watch him work with his own piece, and a couple months ago, I was playing a piece that Christopher Dean wrote for Mr. Dean. And you get to this point, it's funny, whenever you're playing something for the composer where they end up not liking something that they wrote, and they say, well, as the composer of the piece, I think I can change it.
Yeah, it's always interesting.
So, Franco, could you tell us about, generally, when you write a piece, are you pretty much happy with how it turns out in the first place? Or are there any sort of modifications that you find yourself regularly making?
I write quite a bit on the instrument, just trying to figure out like logistics from moving from one place to another. Because of virtual drumline and my kind of background with drumline stuff, I really do a lot of stuff on MIDI. So I'm like really, really intrigued with trying to find some harmonies and stuff that I really, really like. But, you know, it has been a few times, not too much that I decide to change some stuff in my compositions. Because, you know, sometimes it's just things that work on the computer don't really work in person and vice versa. But, you know, I with Frankie, it was one of those times that was the very first time that I was able to work with a piece before it was premiered, you know, so that I wasn't involved in. So it was nice to just kind of be a part of that and kind of figure out what worked and make some changes. Yeah, because even after the premiere, I did end up changing a few orchestrations throughout and was quite happy with what happened afterwards.
Yeah, there's this great clip of Dizzy Gillespie performing his tune Salt Peanuts, and it looks like it's maybe 1970s just based on the fashion that everyone's wearing. But Dizzy Gillespie is known for being a good person to work the audience. And he says, as the composer of Salt Peanuts, it's my job to teach you how the song goes. It's just like really funny to watch him. But anyway, Carly, I think you had a Facebook question for Franco.
I do. Yeah, this one comes from our friend Brian Nosny. He says, what was the most difficult thing to get used to during your first year of teaching full time?
Yes. Yeah. Brian's actually 45 minutes away from me now. I still have to go pay a visit to him. But I guess it was really just kind of taking it all in. For me, it was a very unique situation because we started with a major hurricane. So like having that thrown in the mix was just super, super crazy. But I think it's just... you know, once again, like I said, just getting everything that you've been preparing for, finally being in charge, you know, figuring out, even though that I did know it was coming, that it's not all about just teaching and playing. And there's a lot of other duties and most importantly, email that gets in the way. But, you know, it's just trying to kind of overcome those obstacles and, you know, still find ways to make sure that those obstacles didn't become such an important part of your day when you're there to be teaching and making music with students. So, yeah, that was for me. A lot of the administrative stuff was probably some of the more difficult things.
So I have sort of a follow-up question to that. A lot of time when someone inherits a new position, either they inherit a great percussion studio with a very successful predecessor, and that can be risky because if that person was very well liked, you can sort of end up being a martyr. Like, for example, Casey inherited a great percussion program from Bill Rice, who was very well loved and a very good teacher. And so I'm sure that had its challenges. On the other hand, you can walk into a situation where there's really nothing and you have to build it from scratch. And that's certainly what I have inherited a couple of times. So which of those situations did you find yourself in, Franco? And did you feel pressure from, you know, either angle?
I cleaned these kids up, Ben.
No, I came into a program that, you know, had 31 percussion majors, and it was great. You know, there's a lot of resources. There were a lot of resources, a lot of instruments. It was just a matter of trying to connect with every single person at varying, just, you know, ability levels. So to me, it was really kind of trying to balance it all out and, kind of trying to find time for everybody. I was in one of those positions that it was a visiting, so it was not technically a tenure track at that point. So I just had to deal with it. I had to teach marching band, had to teach all these other percussion methods, repertoire and pedagogy, lessons, percussion ensemble. So it was just a lot of stuff to balance and, you know, it was great work, but it was pretty tiring having those 31 students. But no, again, it was just I learned about a lot about myself and my teaching. And
did you have 31 like hour long music major lessons a week?
Yes. Well, I did have an adjunct.
Okay, I guess
that's split 30 minutes with. Yeah, no, it was pretty intense. You know, and honestly, it was just twice as big as what we needed for the department. So we're back down to reasonable numbers now. But you know, that was kind of trial by fire, which I really liked.
Sure.
But yeah.
Do you guys find, you know, you said twice as many as you needed. I guess the question for anyone, do you find it's particularly challenging with percussion to sell the number you have to the forces out there saying, hey, just recruit and have as many students as possible? I don't know, any thoughts come to mind there? I know it's like I'm really lucky here because I think we all trust each other and we know that, okay, well, if Casey's only accepting very few freshmen, there's a good reason why, and the studio needs to be a certain size. But I don't know, does anyone have any thoughts come to mind when that conversation comes up?
In my situation, when I first got here, I needed all the students I could get. I was like barely making my load. Because I was brand new and I hadn't done any recruiting because I hadn't been here. And then now that I'm on year four here, it's sort of the point where I'm teaching on an overload and I have more students than I'm required to. And it's kind of a nice luxury because while I want every single student to pass, I don't feel like I'm just like completely scraping every last student along, whether they deserve to or not. I mean, you have that luxury of, you don't want to do this, if music's not your thing, I'm not going to try and convince you to stay. It's fine. You can go do something else. So I think that you get to a certain point where it sounds like what Frank was saying is basically you get so much quantity that you're able to narrow it down to a certain quality of students.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I walked in with as well. You know, there were some folks that kind of changed majors, just, you know, my expectations, they weren't quite meeting my expectations, and they didn't do it because of me, but they were like, all right, I think I'm going to go do something else.
Yeah. If this is what it takes, then I'm not.
Yeah.
So I think,
yeah,
I remember I saw, Jerry Junkin, the conductor from the University of Texas Wind Ensemble a while back. And he said something along the lines of, I've never tried to talk anyone into being a music major. I've tried to talk some people out of it.
Right.
Never tried to talk anyone into it. So yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the size of your quality and the, you know, what you already have established. Certainly I'm not trying to just run off people because they're less experienced. I'm happy to work with students that are less experienced, that are hardworking. And I mean, looking at where I came from when I started at FAU, I had 8 students, which I was just adjunct there, but that's not even a full-time load anywhere really. So.
Yeah, sure. Well, now that I hear y'all talk a little more, the thought came to mind, the hardest time I've had explaining this to anybody has been explaining it to parents, you know, parents who wish their kid made it in or didn't, whatever. And you have to explain like, well, I have to accept a limited amount because if there's more than this many people in symphony orchestra, nobody plays. And if there's more than this many in wind symphony, not enough people play. And it's about the health of the students, not so much the bodies in the room. It's about them getting the experience they need. If we have too many, that's the nature of our repertoire more than, you know.
And I mean, furthermore, even beyond the fact of I'm contracted to teach X amount of students, I remember at Miami, Svet would only teach a certain amount of lessons a day. And he said, you know, if I teach for 9 hours in a row, the person getting the 9th lesson of the day, not really getting a good lesson.
It should rotate. It should rotate the 9th person. You have your turn being the 9th.
But it does stand like, you know, I could teach 60 hours of lessons a week if I you know, had that many students, but is the person with the Friday 5 p.m. lesson really going to get a good lesson at that point? It's not right for the students either. Carly, what about you?
I have a lot of thoughts. You know, my transition at FIU when I started there was actually probably the easiest way it could have been, because there was one student there just finishing up on our way out, and I had one brand new freshman in my first year music major. And year by year, like since then, this is my third year. Now we're 7, I think in the spring it's going to be 9, and it's been like, Ben, what you were saying, like from the administration, let's grow. And I'm happy until I've got 12 to 15. We have 3 major ensembles, so that'll be ideal. But actually, Casey, one thing that you said about rotating lessons, I started at New World School of the Arts this year, and there's high school students and college students, and I pull them out of the high schoolers out of class. It's during their school day. And one of the cool things there is they encourage us to rotate. Like, so it's not always the same person first. It's not always the same person last. And I think it's great for the students, because if they always see you at the end of like a 7 or 8 hour stretch of lessons, like you have a different different experience. They have a different experience. Not saying we all teach great and we all care about the quality of every lesson, but it's a different feel when they're fresh, like in the middle of the day or, yeah. So it's cool to do that. It's complicated. It's like a lot of scheduling work, but it's a nice feeling. And I think if it wasn't so complicated, I would try to do it everywhere.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I think this is something that we've addressed at some point on the podcast before, but I'd like to hear Franco's take on it just because this has sort of got my gears in my head turning. Franco, what do you do with a student that comes to a lesson, we'll say completely or mostly unprepared?
It's like an interview. it's like an interview again. Good job, Ben.
You know, I've had it happen a few times. I mean, the first time, you know, we talk and I try to kind of go through and have a practice session with them, you know, so I kind of let them practice for, I watch them practice and I kind of figure out, okay, what might they be doing wrong? And hey, let's try this. Just because, I mean, sometimes, you know, for some students, it's not really apparent that they know exactly the most productive way to practice. So, you know, we talk about that in studio, and as much as we talk about it, like if they don't apply it, then it doesn't really matter. So kind of going through that. And then if it's another time, you know, then we have maybe another conversation or just work on some sight reading, you know, some things that will just kind of get their minds working even in that hour. But I don't know, once it's like the third or luckily I haven't had it more than three times, but you know, it's like, okay, no, see you later, go practice.
No. So when you do talk about practice strategies, like in studio class, what sources do you like to go to? Or, and I guess I open this up to anybody, but yeah, how do you like to talk about that?
You know, some of the books that we read in our repertoire and pedagogy class, you know, the Anders Ericsson Peak, some of those things that he has on there about deliberate practice. Obviously, the 10,000 hour rule. And I think I learned of Colin Hill's dissertation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of really neat stuff in there that's really easy to share. Yeah. And there's another book. I forget the author.
I should say we actually talked to Colin on here about that dissertation. That's a good episode to check out.
Oh, yeah, no, there's a lot of great stuff. At some point, I saw him do a clinic, and it was like the distilled version of that, which is pretty sweet. I have those handouts somewhere. But, yeah, and then there's this new book that came out by Meredith Publications. I forget exactly who it was.
Oh,
by.
Yeah, we mentioned that recently. Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. We mentioned it recently.
Yeah, it's like 50 practical steps or something. That we're currently going through that book right now in one of my classes. So I mean, I think it's just nice to share these little tidbits with them every once in a while.
If I could say something just related to this, because I like the Anders Ericsson book too, and I know somewhere early on in the book he introduces the concept of what's it called, not practical practice, but not focused practice, what's it called, intentional practice, or deliberate practice. There it is. Yeah, deliberate practice. That's how he says it. So he's introducing that concept, and he uses learning tennis as an analogy. And I'm sorry for those of you who remember this, because I know I've said this before on the podcast, but he says, you know, imagine you want to play tennis, and you take a few lessons, and you get good enough to enjoy it, and you get good enough to play with your friends, which was your goal. And great, that's fine. You'll keep your skills up by continuing to play, but eventually someone is going to have, for instance, a serve that you just can't return. Your skills are not at a certain level where you can't yet return that specific serve. So now you need to engage in something called deliberate practice. You have to practice your backhand. You have to practice springing over to the left side where that serve lands, whatever. You have to go through very specific steps. And just playing the way you have been for fun is no longer adequate. Now you're doing deliberate practice. And I think it's like a very easy concept to explain. But with students like you all are talking about, and I'm not necessarily talking about just, you know, say where I'm teaching now, but where I've taught before and other people I've talked to. And so this isn't just a JMU thing at all. But I think the problem is they haven't decided they want to play tennis. It's like, so the book isn't enough. Like the analogy, it makes sense, but it still doesn't work because it's like, well, it's not that you don't get this or that you don't believe in it, or it's that you haven't even decided this is really what you actually want to play yet. You're like kind of, you're still just like hitting the tennis ball around going like, is this what I want to do for a living? I'm not sure. I don't know. And here, have another $40,000. Maybe I'll do this. That's the problem I've seen. It's like that problem is far, far more mysterious to me and harder to tackle.
Well, and there's so many factors in there too. Like sometimes students, you know, sometimes it's self-doubt that they don't want to really go for it. Or sometimes it's like simple scheduling. Like, well, I didn't manage my time. I didn't plan it. Sometimes they don't have time. There's so many. For me, it's always like diagnosing. The talk that we have is what is getting in the way of your practicing.
I think
you were about to say something.
I just wanted to add that I'm afraid that all of us are kind of unintentionally sounding very negative right now. And I wanted to add that on the flip side, it is very fun being a teacher when you have a student that maybe is less experienced that really starts to get it. And sure. I mean, I have students running the gamut of, you know, experience levels. Now I have a student working on Reflections on the Nature of Water, and I have a student working on Cerrone 1. and as a teacher, I get just as much pleasure into going into a lesson with Cerrone 1 and seeing progress and when it's well prepared. And in fact, that can almost be more enjoyable for me because it's so easy to see progress from week to week. I think that for a lot of students with lower confidence levels and lower experience levels to have a successful week of practice and walk into a lesson with an etude very well prepared, which hats off to my student Megan this week for being that student. It's really enjoyable.
That answer's too PC, Ben. I'm going to edit it out.
Don't want to talk about bad students again.
only it's episode 200. We're all supposed to be having some drinks anyway.
So, Franco, speaking of college teaching, we had a question from Aaron Graham who says, hi, Francisco, is there any aspect of your graduate studies that you look back on and feel really helped you to win a college teaching job, specifically in regards to the interview process and your job at Lamar?
Wow. All right. Yeah. So I think it really started when I first got to UK. I had the privilege of both doing my master's and my doctorate at the same school with Jim. And in my very first semester of my master's, you know, he just started talking with the other DMA students. You know, we were all in this graduate colloquium class. And from then, he just started talking about college teaching and the big three, you know, service, teaching, and creative activities and research. And I think it was just from that point on, you know, and Jim was doing a great job of setting us up and kind of making us do the extra mile. And I think, obviously, as you all probably mentioned so many times, you know, it's obviously you've got to be able to play, and that's just a given. But you know, everything that's going further than that, the research, the you know, performing, teaching, you know, that's really kind of, you know, as much part of the job of the university professor, you know, and we might all wish that we can just be playing and teaching the entire time, but going and doing those extra miles and finding what interests you was kind of what I really enjoyed. And having the opportunity to do some things, you know, being a part of the process. Jim would always include us as grad assistants being, you know, running his job. So I think doing a lot of that and having the opportunities to do so kind of set me up to a place where I can think about everything that I had to do. I mean, it's one thing about thinking and kind of doing, but once you do it on yourself, it's still by yourself, it's still difficult, but you know, at least you got that running start, I thought.
It's interesting, something like service, I think of myself, say like my first college interview ever, like I had no idea what service meant to universities. But if you just know a little about it, suddenly you can talk about it with great knowledge. But if you don't know anything about it, it really seems like you know absolutely nothing. So I just think back, and I don't have a doctorate degree, so I probably never quite had a teacher who felt that was their responsibility to help me with that. But yeah, like what a great thing it must have been just to be aware of those things and just to even know that there is a three-way split to some degree of service, creative activity, and teaching. Typically, I didn't know that until I was in one of these jobs, you know. Yeah, and Jim just won some big award, right? Didn't Jim Campbell just win some big
award? Yeah, he won the Lifetime Achievement.
Yeah, in teaching, right?
Yeah.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, way to go, Jim.
Christopher Dean, also my teacher. So congrats to both of us.
Yeah, wow, that's great. It makes sense. Well, I mean, we look at, two schools that have a huge output with doctoral students that get these jobs, UNT and UK. That's really cool.
Franco, we were talking about research, and one thing I wanted to present a topic about today was the Steve Reich Mallet Quartet. So I was going to do this big thing on Steve Reich, but as I mentioned earlier, we're on episode 200, and I started doing my research, and I saw that Steve Reich studied composition with Vincent Persichetti, and I was going, I know that for some reason, and then I looked, and I covered Steve Reich way back on episode 13 with Bill Shultis. So curious for information on Steve Reich, there's a good starting place.
Do it again, encore. No,
let's do that. But Franco wrote his dissertation on the Steve Reich Mallet Quartet, and part of the reason I had been in touch with Franco before the podcast was because I was getting some information on that, and Franco has a really unique approach to the marimba parts and making a reduced part to eliminate 23 out of the 25 page turns in the piece. So Franco, could you tell us about your experience studying that work and any sort of interesting stuff maybe that didn't make the dissertation? And if I could lead with one thing that I would have never noticed, I read Franco's dissertation, and in the study score and the parts for Mallet Quartet, there's a discrepancy. There's one extra bar at the end of, I think it's at the end of the parts. And Franco said in the dissertation, he emailed the publisher and at the time of printing had not heard back.
Yeah.
So did you ever figure out what that was about?
I still haven't heard back. Yeah, there is just like one tiny extra. I think it's like a 3/8 at the very, very end. But that's it. I mean, and you know, every time we just decide which one we're doing. I mean, obviously it's exactly what it is in the parts, but yeah, that study score is slightly different. I think it was the very first time I heard that piece, I was really, really intrigued by it. I've always been, I always gravitated towards the music of Steve Reich, Sixtet, Nagoya Marimbas, all those amazing pieces of art. Once I got going and once we played it for the first time in grad school, that was the one thing I realized, like, I don't want to do this. Like, the only other thing you could do is just memorize it, which is a feat in itself, or have some Bluetooth page turner. And, I just decided to kind of take the matter into my own hands, and I started out with my own, which I've kind of been doing for a while with other pieces. So like Mark Mellott's Gravity has a lot of page turns as a marimbist, where you really don't have the time to do those page turns. So I've been doing it for a while, and I took Adam Slewinski's, he had one of those blogs, Read, Cheat, Memorize, I believe it's called. And I just kind of took that idea that he had in there, and I just made it into a big 11x17 score. So for both the marimba parts, I essentially reduced the 25 pages into two 11x17 pages. So, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird looking at, upon first glance. But once you study the part, I think it's so much easier. You don't have to be straining your eyes. And at that time, I was also suffering from some eye problems just by reading so much music in my master's. So that was kind of also my way of tackling that. But then, the more and more we played it, the more and more I got interested in it, and decided to do some research projects with the theory and analysis portion of it. I just decided to do it as my dissertation because nobody had really talked about it before. I talked to Adam Slewinski and Jason Schutting and David Skidmore a little bit about their experiences with the pieces, and it's just a nice thing that I did finish during that hurricane when I first took my job. It was literally the only reason I was able to finish that dissertation.
Which hurricane was that?
Hurricane Harvey in 2007.
What was it like? Because I've been through a hurricane Carly just went through a hurricane. So did you lose power? Did you lose water?
Yeah, anything the whole city was, the water had gone, like something happened with the water well. So there was no running water for like a week and a half. No power for a week. Luckily, where I was staying, we did have power and internet, so I was able to get some stuff done. But yeah, it was a tragedy, but the one nice light that we had was having the ability for me to be able to finish my dissertation. But
yeah, there you go. Yeah,
I do want to swing back around to the Mallet Quartet in a second because I have a question, but I just wanted to mention, we were talking about practice earlier. And Franco had this wonderful idea to make these reduced parts. And another piece that's a great example of this is I'm right now working on Michael Dougherty's Timpani Concerto, Raise the Roof. And it has a cadenza in it that's 2 pages long. And it's basically constant 16th notes on E. And then you reach out to other pitches. And there's some tuning involved as you're doing that. But basically, there's this melody on very few notes. And it's just, I found it almost impossible to read. And I struggled with it for a day or two. And then finally, I just went home and I wrote out what the melody was. And then I realized there were a couple of bars that repeated in it. And again, I took 2 pages of music and ended up with 5 lines of music that were so much easier to read. And in my brain, I can easily put in some E16th notes. It's not a problem at all. And yeah, I learned the thing in a day easily after that. But swinging, and so I think, yeah, for practice tips, sometimes step away from the instrument, do some score study, figure out what's going on, and maybe even rewrite it. But wrapping back around to Mallet Quartet, because I'm working on that as well right now. Franco, how do you make the third movement easier? Can you put it in 4-4 or something?
Yeah, that one's
not
a beast.
Only is it difficult to keep track, it's also like the most like awkward sort of cringy intervals.
Yeah,
it's stuck in my head. Yeah, we did it 2 semesters ago. It's yeah.
Just count.
Yeah, and like I think honestly, the counting is the easier part. It's just like wrapping your hands around these small awkward intervals on vibraphone. It's so hard.
I think the third movement is my favorite. I love that movement.
I think for me, it's got to be the second. It's just so different.
Yeah, slow one, I think. Yeah, slow. But yeah, the third one is in my head for sure.
Carly, you've played the quartet as well. You played one of the 5 parts, I think.
Yeah.
How was the third movement for you, difficulty-wise, getting around the notes?
I don't remember it being that crazy.
Gotcha. Maybe you
Yeah, Ben.
It's 8 notes. It's not like the most difficult thing in the world. It's not... I don't know, it's not Merlin or anything, but it's just, I just find it so awkward, some of the key signature, more or less.
I don't know, maybe it's a grip thing or, no, to be honest, I played 5-1. some things are, anyway, I played vibraphone.
No one's got chops like you, Casey, we get it.
I think Carly's, I agree, it's hard. Carly is the one saying it's a piece of cake.
Yeah. Well, I haven't played it. I think it's been 5 years now, so I don't know. Maybe I only remember the rose colored part of playing the piece.
I want to know what everyone's favorite Steve Reich piece is. If you had to pick one.
Okay. Everyone's thinking of that. I just want to mention Franco mentioned one piece in his dissertation I had never even heard of, called Typing Music.
Yeah.
it's pretty wild. I looked up a recording of it. It's not that great.
The dude's typing?
It's like, what is it? 2 people clapping, 2 people playing claves, and 2 people doing something else. I can't remember what. Do you remember, Franco?
No, not off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's not great, whatever it is.
Wow.
But anyway.
It was one of the older ones, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Steve Reich's response to the typewriter.
Yeah. I definitely, way better piece is Leroy Anderson's The Typewriter. I like that one.
That one's fantastic.
It's cute.
So, anyone have a favorite Steve Reich piece, Casey had asked?
Yeah, I want to know.
I think probably Music for 18 Musicians.
Yeah, that's hard to beat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe, I really like Different Trains. Different Trains is really special, I think. But yeah, Music for 18 is really great.
2x5, I think, is maybe one of his, not lesser known pieces, but lesser known than Music for 18 or something like that. It's scored for basically two rock bands. It's each group has two guitars, a bass, piano, and drums.
So oh, that's, yeah, I don't know that at all.
Yeah, it's like a bang on a can thing. Yeah, that one's super cool. I mean, also like electric counterpoint, I think everyone has a sweet spot for.
Yeah. Yeah, Franco?
I'd have to say Tech Elim or the Sextet. I love Sextet. It's a bucket list piece for me, and still waiting for the day to do it.
Didn't the Percussion Collective do that at PASIC last year?
Yeah.
I think I sat next to Casey during that concert, actually.
You sat next to me.
Oh, I did? I know I sat next to one of my co-hosts. Yeah.
Carly, Casey.
That's right, because it was a spec concert. Yeah, yeah.
Caleb, Brian, Megan, who knows? Yeah. Yeah. Hey, do you guys want to know what happened in music history today?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's maybe about that time. So, yeah, we're releasing on October 24th. And if you're listening on the day we're releasing, you can tell your friends that today in 2001, composer Bright Sheng received his MacArthur Fellowship worth $500,000. That's what the MacArthur Award was at in 2001. And this is a really huge distinguished honor, and it's a no strings attached award. You simply get this money from the MacArthur Foundation. And this came to mind when I was looking at news, because Bright Sheng's going to be here at JMU campus in just a few weeks for our Contemporary Music Festival. So it'll be really cool to hear a lot of the music of Bright Sheng and see a lecture from him. It's just this really, really cool thing we do here at JMU, is this Contemporary Music Festival. So some other MacArthur fellows, this has nothing to do with October 24th, but I thought it might be fun just to fire off a few of the other big name composers that you may have heard of. Milton Babbitt's also a MacArthur fellow, John Harbison, Gunther Schuller, Osvaldo Goliov, John Zorn, Charles Warren, Julia Wolf, and the first ever MacArthur fellow was Conlon Noncaro, which I thought was really cool, because we've talked about Noncaro on the show quite a bit. Some others you might know: the astounding, very important drummer Max Roach. Carl Haber is someone we talked about, who did the sound recording restoration. We talked about him many, many episodes ago, or reported on how this guy was able to digitally photograph and record, redigitize and make recordings of these old melted wax cylinder recordings, cracked and broken records, and even old tinfoil recordings made of soot that weren't even meant to be played back. They were just meant to make a visual recording of someone's voice, and he managed to make them play back. Someone else to check out who's a MacArthur fellow is Tyshawn Sorey, and I'd love to try to get him on the show sometime. He is a multi-instrumentalist, but seems to do a whole lot of percussion playing. Also, Maren Oslop, the famous conductor, and Dawn Upshaw, very famous soprano. I really like Dawn Upshaw and her voice. I picked one other news item. In 2017, Fats Domino passed away on October 24th at age 89. And just because of the time, I didn't know a ton about Fats Domino. Of course, heard the name, but I dug a little bit into Fats Domino. And Antoine Fats Domino Jr. was American pianist and songwriter, one of the pioneers of rock and roll music. He's sold more than 65 million records. And between 1955 and 1960, he had 11 top 10 hits. And supposedly, he's just this really shy and humble person, and apparently that is why he maybe has been overlooked as far as his contributions to rock and roll. People usually cite Elvis Presley as the father of rock and roll, but Elvis Presley has even said, no, I'm not the king of rock and roll, it is Fats Domino. And supposedly there was this interview, I've got this story. Yeah, Domino was present in an audience of 2,200 people at Elvis Presley's first concert in Las Vegas, July 31st, 1969. At the press conference after the show, a journalist referred to Presley as the king, and Presley gestured towards Fats Domino, who was looking around and off camera and said, no, Presley says that is the king of rock and roll, pointing to Fats Domino. So one other cool thing I want to say, he's one of the biggest stars of rock and roll in the 50s and one of the first rhythm and blues artists to gain popularity among white audiences. His biographer, Rick Coleman, argues that Domino's records and tours with rock and roll shows in that decade, bringing together black and white youths in a shared appreciation of his music, was a factor in the breakdown of racial segregation in the United States. And he did not say that this work was called rock and roll. He said it wasn't anything but the same old rhythm and blues I've been playing down in New Orleans. So one story about desegregation, this is now jumping to May 4th, 1956. He's headlining a rhythm and blues event in Roanoke, Virginia. And the segregation laws at the time, whites and blacks were designated to be sitting in different seating areas. So on this particular occasion, African-American fans occupied the dance floor, while some 2,000 white fans were crammed into the balconies above, and the balcony could fit about half that number. Many of the white fans tried to escape the crush by going downstairs to the less densely packed floor. And as journalists noted, they spotted the two people sharing seats and actually dancing together as Fats Domino ran through an already extensive catalog of hit songs. So sort of along the same lines I reported on Duke Ellington and pushing the boundaries of the segregation laws and performance venues, Fats Domino did too. So he died on the day we're releasing as well. And that's your news.
I just had a couple of follow-ups to that. I talk about Fats Domino in my music appreciation class when we talk about rock and roll.
Oh, and great.
He was the first artist to sell 1 million copies of a rock and roll record for his song, The Fat Man.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it's actually a total musical sound alike of another song called Junker Blues. And we listen to it back to back. It's the same melody. But Fats Domino's has such a driving backbeat that that's cited as the first example of a rock and roll song. That's cool. The transition from rhythm and blues into rock and roll. But then you also mentioned the composer Bright Shing that you're going to have at JMU in a couple weeks. And I just wanted to mention Bright Shing is one of my favorite composers and very well known among the classical music community, but maybe lesser known among percussionists. He does have a couple of works that heavily feature percussion. In particular, I wanted to mention there's a piece called Hot Pepper from 2011 that was, I just pulled up like his website about it. It was commissioned by Camerata Pacifica for a violinist named Catherine Leonard and a marimba player that we all know, Jihye Jung. At some point, I saw a recording of it online, or at least a clip of it. I think it might be on YouTube, but it's one of the, like, there's, you know, marimba and violin, obviously, with marimbalin is an area of interest for us, but I've never heard of anyone playing that work, and it's such a cool piece from what I remember. And then also, Casey, for some reason, didn't mention that Bright Shing wrote a piece in 2014 called Deep Red for solo marimba and 10 other players, and it was, it's been performed, I think it might have been premiered, in fact, by, it was premiered by John Parks, but Pius Ching has been performing that one.
Pius will be here. You know how much I hate promoting Pius Ching.
Is he playing that piece?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, he's coming to play his piece, give a class to all my folks, and, oh yeah, it's going to be just terrible. It's going to be the first. I like how some people still don't get it. They're like, you guys must really hate each other, right? Like, oh yeah, absolutely. Arch enemy.
Carly, I think you had a question for Franco.
Yeah, I do. Franco, I was reading on your website, I saw that you have some experience doing some outreach work in Guatemala with a music program. Would you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. I've been going down there for quite some time. My dad has been doing mission work for quite some time. So I would go down to Honduras and Guatemala and some other countries when I was still in middle school and high school. And more recently, we started going down in 2013 down to Guatemala to teach some of these underprivileged students in their little conservatory. It's just been, we've been going there. They have such a rich culture there with their marimba ensembles. You know, so they get some grants every once in a while to get some new instruments. I've been going down there to teach them, you know, some technique stuff, and then kind of listen to them play. And you know, it's just been a really enriching experience. Just kind of be in touch with them and kind of giving them some motivation, just as they're continuing. You know, because there are some parts of the country are really, really rough, and you know, for them, that 1 hour of music every 2 days is the part they look forward to the most. And it's just awesome, kind of making connections and building friendships down there.
Sure, yeah, that's great. It's great that you're doing that. Do you notice any like big differences in like an educational or percussion related approach there versus what you've experienced in the U.S.?
I mean, for the most part, a lot of the places that I'm going down there, even though it's a conservatory, it's not really classically trained. So they don't start teaching them how to read music until they're about like almost high school age, just because their talent level is so different. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Thanks.
I mean, they're just their technical abilities are just in completely the all over the place. So, you know, they might have a person that just started a week ago, or you know, some folks that have been there for several years. So, it's kind of there are several teachers. There's like a music teacher. There's a guitar teacher. There's a marimba ensemble teacher. There's an art painting teacher there. So, I mean, a lot of the times it's just kind of, you know, doing what works best for them. But, you know, it's just, you know, just kind of having a concert every few weeks. And that's kind of the way they kind of gear themselves. It's just having these deadlines to kind of prepare some new songs for and such. But yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, I did some teaching in Venezuela several years ago, and one of the things that was so unusual for me, I mean, there was a ton to learn about El Sistema, but it was having like really young students, like beginners, 8, 9, 10-year-olds, playing right alongside like an 18 or 20-year-old that had been playing for, you know, 10 years, and they just like every student just tries to absorb as much as they can, and they help each other, and it's different from. Here, most of the time, we're leveling students and separating by ability and experience. And, you know, it's just like a different kind of structure, it sounds like.
Yeah. No, and certainly I went back to this past December, I went back to Honduras to do something as well. And that was for like a drumline thing. But we went out to this other town, and they had just hired somebody who was one of the pivotal figures in the El Sistema. And they just started it for a little string program over in a little town in Honduras. And they're really, really looking forward to it. The kids, they got all these new violins and these new instruments. And it's just incredible, you know, how happy they are just being able to play their instruments. You know? But it's kind of like the same exact thing. Tiny little kids with some high school students that are all at the same pretty much ability level. So,
yeah. Cool. It's so important. It's so, you know, it can make such a huge impact and huge difference in people's lives, just having that experience.
Carly, I think you had a question from Facebook.
Yeah, here's one from Tyler Swick. Tyler asks, how much do you emulate your previous teachers in your own teaching? Do you have a catchphrase yet? And I feel like there must be some backstory or some inside joke that maybe you want to share with us.
No, Tyler also went to UK. He graduated right before I got there, but we, you know, just through a bunch of different hangs, got to meet each other. And Jim has a bunch of catchphrases. You know, it seems like it's changing every year. I'm sure there are new ones already. But you know, in terms of emulating my teachers, I mean, I've had an awesome amount of teachers, you know, at TCU and at UK. And, you know, it's one of these things, while I do absorb a lot of that style and I do, you know, kind of take in what I really and really attracted to in their teaching. You know, I think a lot of it has to do too with the students you teach, you know, cause not, you know, having that connection with students is really important. So, you know, in a certain way, I'm not at the point where I can just kind of, I guess, do whatever I want. I do want to be really, really effective with my teaching. So, you know, the students that I teach at Lamar at a regional university are not going to be the same students that I taught at when I was a grad student at UK. But yeah, no, I think I've learned a lot of really, really good things about them, both at TCU and at UK that I have been integrating in my own teaching. And, you know, just still watching other teachers, not necessarily percussionists, but other instrumentalists do master classes, you know, is always really insightful for me, you know, to kind of develop my teaching style as well.
Yeah, cool. So no catchphrase then?
I mean, my favorite one is, one in a row from Jim. That's pretty much, but not from me.
Does that mean like you did it once, right?
Yeah. That's
I've caught myself. I have so many catchphrases now that I say all the time. And one of my favorites when we're talking about practice is when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Hmm.
Like the student that just wants to put the metronome on slow and bump it up. It's like, that doesn't work for everything. And if it's not working for you now, it's not like you need to find a different strategy for this.
I like when I can really tell my students know me. I'll ask them a question in a group, and one of them, I remember my student Ben just goes, "Guys, this is like Casey easy mode," and answers the question. And it was like, "What's my favorite Halo game?" or something. It had nothing to do with music. Personality thing or something.
Well, as we move toward our wrap up here, I had a couple other things I wanted to mention. One, we were talking about practice earlier. And I wanted to mention that Todd Meehan has started a series. Casey, I think you recorded one of these, something about, what's the series called again?
It's How You Practice, or yeah. How We Practice. Yeah, he let me be the first interview. And yeah, I watched about half the Nancy Zeltzman one. We had some extra time in studio class. And continue. Yeah, How We Practice.
Yeah, I saw some of the Nancy Zeltzman one as well. And then two, I mentioned that we had 8 Hall of Famers and we successfully remembered 6 off the top of our heads. I went back and checked. The other two, I don't know how we missed these, were John Beck and Anthony Cerrone were the other two Hall of Famers that we've had on the podcast.
And we should also thank our subs. So Carly was wise to thank our past and first co-hosts when I started the show, Megan Arnes and Laura Black, two of the originals with Ben and I. And then also we have regular subs who we rotate in. And the first of which I think was Tracy Wiggins, maybe. He was probably the first one. And then Brian Nosny, Brandon Arve, Caleb Pickering, Bill Shaltis, and Brian Calhoun. No.
Yeah. He's sat in on a couple.
He's only been on once.
No, he was on Norm Weinberg, that I remember.
Brian Calhoun was?
Yeah, because I remember I recorded that one when I was in California last year.
All right,
don't test my memory, Casey.
Time out. I'm going to check. I don't think he's been on more. You know, you're probably right.
Yeah. No, I remember that one. He was.
That's what happens when you get to 200 episodes.
Yeah.
Oh, it's impossible.
Try to prepare the same topic twice. Can't remember who's been a sub.
Oh, it's a mess. Yeah.
Brian Calhoun, I appreciate your contributions, even if Casey doesn't realize them.
Oh, you're right. I see it. There it is. Yep, you're right. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah.
Ugh, whatever. This job's too hard.
And thanks to all of our wonderful 200 episodes worth of guests. I imagine we've probably had more than 200 guests because we had some with multiple guests.
For sure.
Thanks to everyone for 200 wonderful episodes. Thank you, Franco Perez, for joining us for this one. And we'll see you on episode 201.
All right. Bye, everyone. Thanks.
Bye.